Chinese president officially welcomes his Iranian counterpart Ibrahim Raisi as Beijing and Tehran seek to strengthen bilateral ties. Russia rejects as unfounded allegations that it's plotting to destabilize Moldova. Also ahead, at least three people are killed and five others injured after a gunman opened fire on a university campus in the US state of Michigan. Welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has been officially welcomed after arriving in Beijing for a state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. A short while ago, Raisi was received by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in an official ceremony. The ceremony was held at the premises of China's National Congress. There, the national anthems of the two countries rang out before the delegations began their talks. Back in Tehran, Raisi had underlined that Iran is in step with China when it comes to countering unilateralism.
Both Iran and China are opposed to unilateralism and support political independence around the world. This shared stance has brought the two countries close enough that they can have good political and economic cooperation at regional and international levels.
Raisi said he would focus on the implementation of the 25-year strategic cooperation agreement signed with China 2 years ago. He said Tehran and Beijing already enjoy close relations, but there's still much room for expanding cooperation in different sectors, including trade and economy. The president said Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has paved the way for closer ties with China. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed in depth the significance of the Iranian president's visit to China. Let's see what our guests had to say.
But I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Tehran, Fuad Izzadi, academic and political analyst, and out of Kitchener, Ontario, Robert Fatina, author and journalist. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Tehran with Mr. Izzadi. Your perspective on the significance of this trip at this time.
You know, we are moving towards a multipolar world. China, it seems, is going to be one of the poles in the New World Order. Iran has the potential to be a pole in the New World Order. And the cooperation of these countries that are resisting U.S. Hegemony, is quite important. It's beneficial for both sides. Iran is obviously under heavy sanctions from the United States, so having a close economic linkage with China is going to be good for Iran. And China is heavily dependent on energy resources of the Persian Gulf. And Iran is the only country that its foreign policy is not dictated from Washington. Other countries in this part of the world are heavily influenced by the United States. That's something that Chinese leaders understand. And so it's beneficial for them to make sure that they have good relations with Iran. It's a win-win situation, and I think in the next 3 days we will see the benefits of this cooperation presented to the public and to the international observers.
Well, Robert Fatina, your take, it almost appears as if the United States is forcing more and more alliances because of the unilateral policies that it has, the sanctions, and all-out pressure on so many countries. Your assessment of the United States' moves that perhaps actually encourages and forces many of these type alliances?
Yes, certainly. Things like the sanctions against Iran, the aggressive rhetoric against China, these have the opposite effect of what the United States wants them to have. When the United States sanctioned Iran, it hoped that the Iranian government would come back to the bargaining table. That didn't happen. Instead, Iran went elsewhere, in this case to China, to establish alliances. They'll be military, they'll be economical. They will be things that will benefit the people of Iran, which is what the Iranian government should do. So the U.S. is, in wanting to ostracize different countries, it's causing them to join together into alliances, which will help them become more powerful, will become more of a check to the United States, which is a very good thing, because the United States for so many decades has just operated around the world in a very destructive and very negative manner. It's estimated to have killed at least 20 million people since the end of World War II. And Iran and China, with their growing alliances, can act as a check to that, because the U.S. may be a little less willing to engage in some military misadventures anywhere in the world, knowing that it will be opposed to by this powerful new union. So the United States government, as usual, is not doing anything that benefits its own people or the people of the world. In fact, it acts to their detriment on a regular basis.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this news review of what is the academic and political analyst out of Tehran, Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Ontario. Thanks you so much for being with us on this news review.
The UN chief, meanwhile, says Syria has agreed to open two more border crossings to allow in aid into militant-held areas affected by last week's devastating earthquake. Antonio Guterres says the crossings will allow more and faster aid delivery from Turkey into northwestern Syria. Previously, the Bab al-Hawa crossing was the only conduit for the delivery of humanitarian aid into the region. Syria is concerned that the border crossings are used to supply Western arms to terrorists. On Monday, the UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting on the humanitarian situation in Syria following the quake. This is what the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations had to say to the reporters following the meeting.
During today's meeting, I convey to the Council that the Syrian government has repeatedly expressed its commitment to deliver humanitarian aid to Syrians, whatever they are on the Syrian soil. And I also affirmed that Northwest Syria is an integral part of Syrian lands, and that our people there are part of the Syrian people. And Syria will not accept that they be divided based on lines drawn by terrorist armed groups. Based on that, Syria supports the entry of humanitarian aid into the region through all possible cross points, whatever from inside Syria or across the borders, for the period of 3 months.
Earlier, the UN also warned that terrorists in control of northern Syria are hampering the delivery of aid by Damascus. More than 4 million people live in militant-controlled areas of northwestern Syria. UN experts are calling on the international community to stop Israel's systematic demolition of Palestinian homes and construction of settlements in the occupied West Bank. The experts said Israel should be held to account for the acts of, quote, domicide. They added that the regime's direct attacks on Palestinian homes, schools, livelihoods, and water sources is now threatening their very existence. The UN experts also expressed regret that Israel is committing human rights violations and potential war crimes with impunity. In January alone, the regime reportedly demolished over 130 Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank. This figure represents a 135% increase compared to the same period in 2022. This, as the regime has been facilitating the expansion of settlements which are illegal under international law. Palestinian resistance factions have held a conference in the besieged Gaza Strip to drum up support for Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank amid the increasing Israeli aggression and the use of lethal force against Palestinians. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more from Gaza.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resist the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Turning to other news now, Bahrain's top cleric Sheikh Isa Al-Qasim says the anniversary marking the country's 2011 uprising is an occasion to spread the message of unity. The cleric said the Bahraini people need to amplify their efforts for change. He blasted the Al Khalifa regime for marginalizing the people. He also denounced the violation of the rights of political opponents and other dissenting voices held in Bahraini jails. He said some of those being freed from the prisons are either physically disabled or mentally tortured. Sheikh Qasim was addressing the Bahraini nation on the eve of the popular uprising that began in the kingdom on February 14, 2011. People in Bahrain have taken to the streets on a regular basis to demand social equality and the end of the monarchy. The Manama regime, however, responded to the demands with an iron fist, clamping down on any form of dissent. Russia has dismissed an allegation by Moldova that Moscow is plotting to destabilize the country. Russia's foreign ministry has censured the claims as completely unfounded. The ministry is blaming Ukraine for stirring tensions between Russia and Moldova. It has said Kiev is trying to draw Moldova into a tough confrontation with Russia. This comes after Moldovan President Maia Sandu accused Moscow of planning to use foreign saboteurs to bring down the country's leadership. She said Moscow seeks to prevent her country from joining the European Union and use it in the war in Ukraine. Next to the Belgian capital, Brussels, where NATO defense ministers have gathered for a meeting on Ukraine. There, the NATO chief has promised more support for Kiev after accusing Russia of preparing for new offensives, that is.
We see no signs that President Putin is preparing for peace. What we see is the opposite. He is preparing for more war, for new offensives and new attacks. So it makes it just even more important that NATO allies and partners provide more support to Ukraine.
Stoltenberg also says the alliance should provide Ukraine with the weapons it needs to win the war. He says the allies are discussing delivery of aircraft to Ukraine. However, he says the top priority is to send more heavy weapons and other military equipment. This comes after Ukraine's president pleaded for combat planes during his recent European tour. Stoltenberg also accused Russia of planning a new major operation in Ukraine. Moscow has hit back, describing NATO as a hostile organization. The Kremlin says the alliance is making its involvement in Ukraine conflict ever clearer by its comments. At least three people are confirmed dead in yet another incident of gun violence in the United States. Five others have been hospitalized after the shooting at Michigan State University. Some of them are in life-threatening condition. The incident saw a gunman open fire at several sites inside the campus. He later shot himself dead. The university attack came nearly 14 months after a teenager killed four people at a high school in Oxford, Michigan. The U.S. has seen a surge in gun violence over the past years. Such incidents have killed 25 people since the beginning of the year. That brings an end to International Bulletin for this hour.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution statement addressed to the Iranian nation on the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In its first step, the revolution turned the disgraceful regime and the tyrannical monarchy into a popular and democratic state and employed the elements of national determination, which is the essence of comprehensive and genuine progress, to the heart of the country's governance. Then it turned the youth into the main forerunners of the developments and the key players in the management of the country. It conveyed the message of "we can do it" spirit and belief to everyone. Thanks to the enemy's sanctions, it taught everyone to rely on domestic capacities, and this unfolded a source of great blessings.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Firstly, it guaranteed the stability and security of the country, the territorial integrity, and the protection of the borders which were targeted by the enemy's Syria threats, and gave rise to the miracle of the victory in the 8-year war, leading to the defeat of the Ba'athist regime and its American, European, and Eastern supporters. Secondly, it acted as the country's regime in developing the field of science and technology, and in creating the vital economic and constructional infrastructures which continue to grow more prevalent day by day. Several thousands of knowledge enterprises, several thousands of infrastructure and necessary projects for the country in the areas of civil engineering and transportation, industry, power, mining, healthcare, agriculture and water, millions of universities, graduates or students, thousands of colleges and universities throughout the country, dozens of big projects such as the nuclear fuel cycle, stem cells, nanotechnology, biotechnology, etc., all ranking among the top of the world, developing 60 times more non-oil exports and nearly 10 times more industrial units. The quality of the industrial sector advanced tens of times more than before. The industry that only relied on assembling and montage was transformed into domestic technology.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Russia-Ukraine war is about to enter its first anniversary within days. So far, thousands of people have been killed and many more displaced. Now, after nearly 1 year, the war has turned into a bigger conflict, an encounter, rather, between the West and Russia. Many countries, including the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K., have been fanning the flames of the conflict by sending military aids worth billions of dollars. In the U.S., there has been a long debate among politicians on whether to support Kiev in its war with Russia. Some back the U.S. support for Ukraine. Others, however, take a different stance. Among them is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill which calls for an immediate end to U.S. military and financial support for Ukraine. The resolution also urges the warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
How much more for Ukraine? Is there any limit? Which billionth dollar really kicks in the door? Which red line we set will we not later cross?
Throughout the war, Gaetz has been critical of U.S. support for Ukraine and has previously called for an end to the policy.
I will not vote for one more dollar to Ukraine. I will not vote for one more piece of materiel to Ukraine. We are far too entangled, in this conflict. I believe we have extended this conflict. And I call on the Secretary of Defense to declassify the Inspector General report on the compliance with our existing regulations regarding chain of custody with materiel going to another country.
Gates has also taken a jab at President Joe Biden. In a statement on his resolution, Gates said President Joe Biden must have forgotten his prediction from March 2022, suggesting that arming Ukraine with military equipment will escalate the conflict to World War III. He added America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars toward a foreign war. We must suspend all foreign aid for the war in Ukraine and demand that all combatants in this conflict reach a peace agreement immediately. Gates' resolution has so far received 10 co-sponsors, including Andy Biggs from Arizona, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, Anna Paulina Luna from Florida, Thomas Massey from Kentucky, and Mary Miller from Illinois. The bill introduced by Gates notes that the U.S. has already authorized over $110 billion to spend on the war in less than a year. The resolution comes after a series of escalations of U.S. military aid, including M1 Abrams tanks. It also comes at a time when Ukraine is seeking fighter jets from the U.S. and its allies. Each escalation risks a direct clash between Russia and NATO, which could quickly spiral into a nuclear war. But where does this rising U.S. opposition to continue aid to Ukraine come from? If U.S. taxpayers knew that half the income tax dollars that they sent to the Internal Revenue Service every year was being spent on weapons, war, and war preparation, political support for such programs might significantly decline. As a matter of fact, no agency of the federal government communicates to taxpayers how Congress spends their money. Purchasing weapons and military services with taxpayer dollars has always been, and continues to be, a highly profitable endeavor for defense contractors. But it is in a real war, like as in Ukraine, that such profiteering truly thrives. President Joe Biden's budget proposal to Congress for 2023 included $813 billion for the Pentagon and military expenditures. This is more than half the income taxes citizens send to the federal government each year, and a more than $31 billion increase over the already bloated fiscal year 2022 Pentagon budget. It is also more than the defense budgets of the eight next biggest military spenders put together, including Russia, China, and India. One of the components of the $782 billion Pentagon budget is for the purchase of new nuclear-armed submarines, even though the U.S. already has 14 lethal Ohio-class submarines, each capable of launching 192 nuclear warheads. Canceling two of these unnecessary and provocative new weapon systems would save more than $10 billion. All in all, what seems to be a non-negotiable is the U.S. taxpayers' money, which could and can be allocated to other needs. What seems to be clear, not only to American taxpayers, but to the whole world, is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the only one who benefits most from such aid.
Back in September 2022, a number of blasts occurred in the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipelines. Following the attacks, there were gas leaks around the pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea. Both pipelines are majority owned by the Russian majority state-owned gas company Gazprom. Back then, there was much speculation about who may have been behind the sabotage act, but now a leading U.S. journalist has blamed the blasts on the Washington regime. In a detailed report published in his blog, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has claimed that the bombing of the Nord Stream underwater gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea was ordered by the White House and carried out by the CIA with the help of the U.S. Navy. Hersh says the finding is based on his own investigation into the September sabotage. He says U.S. Navy deep-sea divers planted the high-powered C-4 explosives under the gas pipelines under the guise of NATO naval exercises. The bombs were detonated on September 26th. With a remote signal sent by a sonar buoy, which was dropped near the Nord Stream pipelines by a Norwegian Navy P-8 surveillance plane. The planning process began back in December 2021 when a special task force was created with the direct participation of U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The White House dismissed the report, but Russian officials say the published facts should become the basis for an international investigation. Russian Foreign Ministry says the United States has questions to answer over its alleged role in explosions. Earlier this month, Germany's public prosecutor general Peter Frank said that Berlin has no evidence linking Russia to the sabotage of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines. According to Hirsch, the Biden administration was focused on Nord Stream pipelines because as long as European countries like Germany remained dependent on those pipelines for cheap natural gas, they would be reluctant to give military aid to Ukraine for a war with Russia, which was looming back then. The U.S. was a major opponent of the Nord Stream pipelines. In 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Nord Stream 2 turned Europe into a hostage of Russia and placed sanctions on any company assisting Russia to complete the pipeline. In December 2020, then-President-elect Joe Biden expressed his opposition to the opening of the new pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Swedish and Danish investigators have already found that the ruptures were a result of sabotage, but they have not specified who was responsible. The attacks occurred in exclusive economic zones of the two European countries. The 1,200-kilometer pipelines, operated by Russian gas giant Gazprom, are not currently in operation. Since the blast occurred, Moscow has blamed the West for the damage to the infrastructure. According to reports, the decision to undermine the Nord Stream 1 and 2 was agreed upon and approved personally by the U.S. President Joe Biden, that he discussed the issue with his inner circle for more than 9 months.
Senator Cruz, like you, I am, and I think the administration is very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea.
The Russian government described the sabotage as a terrorist attack and said that the U.S. was the nation that benefited most from it by speeding up Europe's attempts to wean itself off Russian gas.
A devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck southeastern Turkey and northwestern Syria early on Monday. The deadly quake and a string of aftershocks have killed thousands of people in both countries and injured more. Hundreds of buildings in both Syria and Turkey have been reduced to rubbles. Rescue workers are still working in freezing temperatures to find those still trapped under debris. While Turkey has been aided by its allies and Western partners to cope with the crisis, aid is trickling to sanctions-hit Syria. Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has highlighted Syria's need for humanitarian assistance, warning that the U.S. sanctions have worsened the circumstances as the illegal bans have prevented the delivery of everything to the country. The catastrophe of the earthquake that struck Syria is great, and what has increased its depth is the difficult circumstances that the country has been going through for the past 12 years as it's fighting terrorism and its supporters. What exacerbated the tragedy and catastrophe was the sanctions imposed by the United States and Western countries on Syria. The Syrian top diplomat further said that Damascus had appealed to the member states of the United Nations, the General Secretariat of the organization, its relevant agencies and funds, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and other humanitarian action partners from international, governmental, and non-governmental organizations to extend a helping hand and support Syria's efforts to confront the crisis.
You know, given that the war situation and economic, financial, unilateral, illegal, unilateral, inhumane Western sanctions imposed on Syria, at the same time when the U.S. Is imposing, and with its Western allies, imposing almost a blockade around Syria.
A
As Syria is reeling from the aftermath of the deadly earthquakes, the United States is working with partners to provide earthquake relief in Syria, but will stand firm against working with Syria's legitimate government headed by President Bashar al-Assad. The United States has refused normalization of relations with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad or any direct reconstruction aid.
Lots of the airplane, cargo airplane, refused to land on Syrian airports because of the American and European sanctions. So even those countries who want to send humanitarian assistance, they cannot use the airplane cargo because of the sanctions.
Washington listed Syria as a state sponsor of terrorism in 1979, but since the beginning of the imposed war on Syria in 2011, the United States and its Western allies have imposed a number of economic sanctions and restrictions on Syria. U.S. sanctions intensified with the passing of the CISA Act in 2019, which was signed by former President Donald Trump. The sanctions have severely affected the Syrian economy, especially its construction, finance and energy sectors, and complicated the reconstruction effort.
The hurdles we have, if I talk about the area under government control, we don't have an access problem in terms of authorizations, but we have an access problem in terms of the capacity of the infrastructure to authorize that, to enable us to do it. I mean, this means we might have to repair a few roads here and there. And we're not the only one. The government is also working on that. But we are in a situation where it was already difficult to do that before. And now we're in a situation where we don't have any other option than doing it.
Syria has been in the throes of foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. While the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group was crushed by the Syrian government, militant outfits continue to hold sway in some parts of the country under the patronage of Western powers. The United States has also established several military bases in northern Syria in a bid to help the terrorists there. Meanwhile, Iran has sent several batches of humanitarian aid to Syria to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The latest batch of aid included food, blankets, and carpets. Iran will send more humanitarian supplies to Syria in the coming days. Iran has urged the international community to put pressure on the U.S. to lift its cruel sanctions on Syria to facilitate aid deliveries. The Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement has also sent convoys of humanitarian aid to earthquake-affected areas in Syria.
One of Joe Biden's promises during his presidential campaign was to immediately move to end all support for the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. In February 2021, Biden stood at a podium at the State Department and proclaimed that the war in Yemen must end. Biden underlined the humanitarian crisis as the key reason the United States withdrew support.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
An investigation by the Government Accountability Office found that the United States is training the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S. has troops on the ground in Yemen. Biden confirmed that the United States has troops in Yemen in a letter to Congress in June last year. Simply put, he lied to the world when he claimed that the United States was withdrawing U.S. troops for the war in Yemen in 2021. On the contrary, the United States is making billions of dollars from the war in Yemen, as 200,000 have been killed from direct violence. According to data acquired from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, between 2015 and 2021, the United States sent $54.2 billion in weapons and services to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In addition, the Department of Defense provided $644 million for military training to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, almost entirely through the Foreign Military Sales Program. The DoD uses acquisition and cross-servicing agreements to bill nations for logistical support and items ranging from flying hours, fuel, and bombs. Saudi Arabia paid the United States $157 million in flying hours, and the UAE paid $104 million for flying hours since the Saudi-led intervention began in Yemen in 2015. The United States billed Saudi Arabia and the UAE for $319 million in acquisition and cross-servicing agreements for logistical support. Also, the United States sent $18.6 billion in missiles, $6.2 billion in aircraft, $3.3 billion in ships, and $2.8 billion in military training to attack one of the poorest nations in the world. The United States is well aware that the coalition is not fighting an advanced military in Yemen. Billions of dollars have been spent destroying the country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. The UN Security Council approved a resolution to blockade Yemen since 2015 to prevent arms from flooding the conflict. However, the embargo has only succeeded in starving the Yemenis into famine. On a February 9th phone call in 2022 with the King of Saudi Arabia, Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Biden assured him that the United States would continue to support the war in Yemen. The phone call came 1 year after Biden lied to the world and announced that the U.S. was withdrawing its support of the war in Yemen. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency's Defense Institute of International Legal Studies conducted training at the Saudi War College that focused on the law of armed conflict, including laws related to air-to-ground targeting in May 2017, April 2018, June 2019, and May 2020. The DoD claims they are not responsible for civilian deaths because they provided the Saudis with training to avoid civilian casualties. According to the Yemen Data Project, over 23,000 Saudi-led coalition airstrikes since March 2015 have led to thousands of civilian casualties. A Yemeni human rights organization has warned that the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as well as the crippling siege in the impoverished Arab country, could result in the death of thousands of children suffering from cancer. Intisaf, Organization for Women's and Children's Rights, said in a statement on the occasion of World Cancer Day that more than 3,000 Yemeni children who have developed cancer as a result of Saudi aggression and the tight sea, land, and air blockade on the country are now at significant risk of death. The rights group criticized the international organizations and other relevant bodies for neglecting Yemeni cancer patients over the past years. Intisaf added that the incidence of leukemia is increasing among Yemeni children, saying the cases of kids suffering from blood cancer have soared from 300 to 700 in the capital Sana'a due to the use of internationally banned weapons supplied by the United States and the United Kingdom and used by Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Approximately 1,000 children are also believed to have contracted leukemia in other Yemeni regions due to the same reasons. The rights organization pointed to the dire shortage of medicine needed for the treatment of patients diagnosed with cancer because of the Saudi-led military onslaught and siege, stating that many children lose their lives as a result. The human rights organization noted that the economic hardships caused by the ongoing military aggression and blockade have prevented minor cancer patients from seeking treatment abroad, calling for the opening of Sana'a International Airport for humanitarian purposes. It finally held Saudi Arabia and its allies fully responsible for all crimes and violations being perpetrated against the Yemeni nation, especially children, urging the international community to bear the legal and humanitarian responsibility for the violations against the civilians. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the U.S. and other Western states, launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi. The Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, leaving hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and spawning the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام رب عالم قد قتله جهله وعلمه معه لا ينفعه.
أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام said, often, the ignorance of a learned man ruins him, while the knowledge he has does not avail him.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. So, the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, a beautiful discussion which we have had with you listeners for quite some time. We have talked about over the various different programs about the intricacies of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We have seen this universal persona from many different aspects. But one of the things that we had not done in our initial discussions and in our initial programs was this idea that why should this universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam be followed? What traditions are there? What statements are there? And who made these statements in order to tell us that this universal persona, which we have talked about at great length, why this universal persona should be followed and obeyed? It's very interesting. There's this one place where the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, says that if a servant worships Allah between the rukn and the maqam for thousands of years, and then passes away and dies while being an enemy of Ali, Allah will throw them into hell on their face, and they will be in the abyss of hell forever. This really is an amazing tradition which talks about the importance of following and loving and obeying the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, of course, who speaks from wahi, he does not speak from his own carnal or base self or his own desires or his own fancies or his own whims. This individual who is the Messenger of Allah from beginning to end, he is the seal of prophethood. He says that if a servant, an abid, worships the Almighty Allah between the rukn and the maqam, which itself is probably one of the most holiest places of Islam, and they do so for thousands and thousands of years on one side, but on the other side they die while being an enemy to Imam Ali alayhi salam, Allah the Almighty will still throw them into the fires of hell. Now, it makes you think, how is this even possible? How can we say that the worship of thousands of years in such a sacred place will still end up having one thrown into the depths of hell because they had enmity with Imam Ali alayhi salam? Well, this is precisely where this idea of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam and how it must be followed comes into play. If one is an enemy of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and we put the other traditions together and we realize that the Messenger has said that his existence is the existence of Ali, and the treasure of the knowledge of the Messenger is Imam Ali alayhi salam, then of course one who becomes an enemy of His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, is in reality an enemy of the Messenger of Allah, is in reality an enemy of the Holy Quran, and is in reality an enemy of Islam and the Almighty Allah. And so it is in this manner that we realize the utmost importance of following the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And along those lines, if it is of utmost importance to follow the universal persona of Imam Ali, then it is of utmost importance to know and research and understand what is the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. A very thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of none other than Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرضه وحجته على عباده السلام عليك يا أمير
المؤمنين. Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen. I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And if you really look at this ayah, this one sentence, اليوم أكملت لكم دينكم وأتممت عليكم نعمتي ورضيت لكم الإسلام دينا, in the context of the event of Ghadir where it was revealed, you know, then you understand what is the importance of the words of the sixth Imam when he says the namaz and the fasting and the zakat and the charity and the hajj, everything has no meaning, has no positive consequences in the akhirah if you don't have the wilayat of Ali and Ali Ali. And not only that, this whole issue actually can even be understood very clearly. If you look at the story of human beings, the early days of this story of insan, I think the story of Adam alayhi salam is a very powerful story. There are so many things we can learn there. And even this issue of imamat and khilafat, you know, you don't really have to only talk about Islam. You can actually go to the early days when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created the first human being, Adam. There you will see many indications of the concepts that we talk about, imamat and wilayat. You look at the background of shaitan. And it's important. You know, we have to know the opposites. You can't only say, only talk about the positive. You also have to recognize the negative to understand the positive. Look at shaitan. What was the status of shaitan? He was from the jinn. He was not even from the malaika. But because of his ibadat, for centuries he worshipped Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in such a way that his status elevated up and up and up till this jinn now is given the privilege of moving around in the assembly of the malaika. He's allowed to stay with the malaika. And that is where you see that, you know, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created the image of Adam, before putting the ruh and the soul, he basically told that assembly of the malaika, the angels. But Iblis was there, because he had that status and that privilege to move around with the angels. And if you look at, because of that, you know, he was on that level. And his ma'rifat is not...